good horse, I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune.
I used to think that the mechanical worldview had imposed on us mechanical structures and that our societies were really built like machines. But the fact is that you can't turn living things into machinery. You can try to force them to behave like machinery, but they will not be machinery. And that's exactly why our economists can't predict anymore and our politics is falling apart, because we don't understand them as unhealthy living systems. We're trying to fix them like machines.
The rich ones, how oftentimes we go there.
You're listening to episode 655 of Unwelcome Guests, Unite and Conquer, Part 3. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard a recording from the 1990s of evolutionary biologist Elizabeth Souturis, who was featured in episode 531, Unite and Conquer, Part 2. At that time, I was thinking very much about the unification of humanity, unification of life. Going to be looking at that topic, but also this week at the unification of the hemispheres, the left-right brain balance that we looked at in episode 652. Now we're going to start with a dramatic talk on that theme. Thanks to TED for this talk. This is their second most popular talk. Brain scientist Jill Bolte Taylor speaking in 2008. About her stroke of insight.
I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who has been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. And as a sister, and later as a scientist, I wanted to understand, why is it that I can take my dreams, I can connect them to my reality, and I can make my dreams come true? What is it about my brother's brain and his schizophrenia that he cannot connect his dreams to a common and shared reality, so they instead become delusion? So I dedicated my career to research into the severe mental illnesses, and I moved from my home state of Indiana to Boston, where I was working in the lab of Dr. Francine Bennis in the Harvard Department of Psychiatry. And in the lab, we were asking the question, what are the biological differences between the brains of individuals who would be diagnosed as normal control, as compared with the brains of individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia, schizoaffective, or bipolar disorder? So we were essentially mapping the microcircuitry of the brain, which cells are communicating with which cells, with which chemicals, and then in what quantities of those chemicals. So there was a lot of meaning in my life because I was performing this type of research during the day. But then in the evenings and on the weekends, I traveled as an advocate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. But on the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up to discover that I had a brain disorder of my own. A blood vessel exploded in the left half of my brain. And in the course of 4 hours, I watched my brain completely deteriorate in its ability to process all information. On the morning of the hemorrhage, I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. I essentially became an infant in a woman's body. If you've ever seen a human brain, it's obvious that the two hemispheres are completely separate from one another. And I have brought for you a real human brain. Thank you. So this is a real human brain. This is the front of the brain, the back of the brain with the spinal cord hanging down. And this is how it would be positioned inside of my head. And when you look at the brain, it's obvious that the two cerebral cortices are completely separate from one another. For those of you who understand computers, our right hemisphere functions like a parallel processor, while our left hemisphere functions like a serial processor. The two hemispheres do communicate with one another through the corpus callosum, which is made up of some 300 million axonal fibers. But other than that, the two hemispheres are completely separate. Because they process information differently, each of our hemisphere think about different things, they care about different things, and dare I say, they have very different personalities. Excuse me. Thank you. It's been a joy. Our right human hemisphere is all about this present moment. It's all about right here, right now. Our right hemisphere, it thinks in pictures, and it learns kinesthetically through the movement of our bodies. Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems, and then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what this present moment smells like and tastes like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like. I am an energy being connected to the energy all around me through the consciousness of my right hemisphere. We are energy beings connected to one another through the consciousness of our right hemispheres as one human family. And right here, right now, we are brothers and sisters on this planet, here to make the world a better place. And in this moment, we are perfect, we are whole, and we are beautiful. My left hemisphere, our left hemisphere, is a very different place. Our left hemisphere thinks linearly and methodically. Our left hemisphere is all about the past, and it's all about the future. Our left hemisphere is designed to take that enormous collage of the present moment and start picking out details, and more details about those details. It then categorizes and organizes all that information, associates it with everything in the past we've ever learned, and projects into the future all of our possibilities. And our left hemisphere thinks in language. It's that ongoing brain chatter that connects me and my internal world to my external world. It's that little voice that says to me, "Hey, you got to remember to pick up bananas on your way home. I need them in the morning." It's that calculating intelligence that knows, that reminds me when I have to do my laundry. But perhaps most important, it's that little voice that says to me, "I am. I am." And as soon as my left hemisphere says to me, "I am," I become separate. I become a single, solid individual, separate from the energy flow around me and separate from you. And this is the portion of my brain that I lost on the morning of my stroke. On the morning of the stroke, I woke up to a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was the kind of pain, caustic pain, that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it just gripped me. And then it released me. And then it just gripped me. And then it released me. And it was very unusual for me to ever experience any kind of pain, so I thought, okay, I'll just start my normal routine. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider, which is a full body, full exercise machine. And I'm jamming away on this thing, and I'm realizing that my hands look like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I thought, that's very peculiar, and I looked down at my body, and I thought, whoa, I'm a weird looking thing. And it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar, and my headache was just getting worse, so I get off the machine, and I'm walking across my living room floor, and I realize that everything inside of my body has slowed way down. And every step is very rigid and very deliberate. There's no fluidity to my pace, and there's this constriction in my area of perception, so I'm just focused on internal systems. And I'm standing in my bathroom getting ready to step into the shower, and I could actually hear the dialogue inside of my body. I heard a little voice saying, "Okay, you muscles, you got to contract, and you muscles, you relax." And then I lost my balance, and I'm propped up against the wall. And I looked down at my arm, and I realized that I can no longer define the boundaries of my body. I can't define where I begin and where I end, because the atoms and the molecules of my arm blended with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And all I could detect was this energy. And I'm asking myself, what is wrong with me? What is going on? And in that moment, my left hemisphere brain chatter, went totally silent. Just like someone took a remote control and pushed the mute button. Total silence. And at first I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online, and it says to me, hey, we got a problem, we got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out into the consciousness, and I affectionately refer to this space as La La Land. But it was beautiful there. Imagine what it would be like to be totally disconnected from your brain chatter that connects you to the external world. So here I am in this space, and my job and any stress related to my job, it was gone. And I felt lighter in my body. And imagine all of the relationships in the external world and any stressors related to any of those, they were gone. And I felt this sense of peacefulness. And imagine what it would feel like to lose 37 years of emotional baggage. Oh, I felt euphoria. It was beautiful there. And then again, my left hemisphere comes online and it says, hey, you've got to pay attention. We've got to get help. And I'm thinking, I got to get help. I got to focus. So I get out of the shower and I mechanically dress and I'm walking around my apartment and I'm thinking, I got to get to work. Can I drive? And in that moment, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. And then the next thing my brain says to me is, wow, this is so cool. This is so cool. How many brain scientists have the opportunity to study their own brain from the inside out? And then it crosses my mind, but I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a stroke. It's like, okay, I can't stop the stroke from happening, so I'll do this for a week or two, and then I'll get back to my routine. Okay, so I got to call help. I got to call work. I could remember the number at work. So I remembered in my office I had a business card with my number on it. So I go into my business room. I pull out a 3-inch stack of business cards, and I'm looking at the card on top. And even though I could see clearly in my mind's eye what my business card looked like, I couldn't tell if this was my card or not, because all I could see were pixels. And the pixels of the words blended with the pixels of the background and the pixels of the symbols, and I just couldn't tell. And then I would wait for what I call a wave of clarity. And in that moment, I would be able to reattach to normal reality. And I could tell, that's not the card. It took me 45 minutes to get 1 inch down inside of that stack of cards. In the meantime, for 45 minutes, the hemorrhage is getting bigger in my left hemisphere. I do not understand numbers. I do not understand a telephone, but it's the only plan I have. So I take the phone pad and I put it right here. I take the business card, I put it right here, and I'm matching the shape of the squiggles on the card to the shape of the squiggles on the foam pad. But then I would drift back out into La La Land and not remember if I'd already dialed those numbers. So I had to wield my paralyzed arm like a stump and cover the numbers as I went along and pushed them so that as I would come back to normal reality, I'd be able to tell, yes, I've already dialed that number. Eventually, the whole number gets dialed, and I'm listening to the phone, and my colleague picks up the phone, and he says to me, and I think to myself, oh my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever. And so I say to him, clear in my mind, I say to him, this is Jill, I need help. And what comes out of my voice is, roo, roo, roo. And I think, oh my gosh, I sound like a golden retriever. So I didn't know that I couldn't speak or understand language until I tried. So he recognizes that I need help, and he gets me help. And a little while later, I'm riding in an ambulance from one hospital across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And I curl up into a little fetal ball. And just like a balloon with the last bit of air just right out of the balloon, I just felt my energy lift and just, I felt my spirit surrender. And in that moment, I knew that I was no longer the choreographer of my life, and either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was perhaps my moment of transition. When I woke later that afternoon, I was shocked to discover that I was still alive. When I felt my spirit surrender, I said goodbye to my life, and my mind was now suspended between two very opposite planes of reality. Stimulation coming in through my sensory systems felt like pure pain. Light burned my brain like wildfire, and sounds were so loud and chaotic that I could not pick a voice out from the background noise, and I just wanted to escape. Because I could not identify the position of my body in space, I felt enormous and expansive, like a genie just liberated from her bottle. And my spirit soared free like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria. Nirvana. I found nirvana. And I remember thinking, there's no way I would ever be able to squeeze the enormousness of myself back inside this tiny little body. But then I realized, but I'm still alive. I'm still alive, and I have found nirvana. And if I have found nirvana, and I'm still alive, then everyone who is alive can find nirvana. And I pictured a world filled with beautiful, peaceful, compassionate, loving people who knew that they could come to this space at any time and that they could purposely choose to step to the right of their left hemispheres and find this peace. And then I realized what a tremendous gift this experience could be. What a stroke of insight this could be to how we live our lives. And it motivated me to recover. 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, the surgeons went in and they removed a blood clot the size of a golf ball that was pushing on my language centers. Here I am with my mama, who's a true angel in my life. It took me 8 years to completely recover. So, who are we? We are the life force power of the universe with manual dexterity and two cognitive minds. And we have the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in the world. Right here, right now, I can step into the consciousness of my right hemisphere where we are. I am the life force power of the universe. I am the life force power of the 50 trillion beautiful molecular geniuses that make up my form, at one with all that is. Or I can choose to step into the consciousness of my left hemisphere where I become a single individual, a solid, separate from the flow. Separate from you. I am Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, intellectual, neuroanatomist. These are the we inside of me. Which would you choose? Which do you choose? And when? I believe that the more time we spend choosing to run the deep inner peace circuitry of our right hemispheres, the more peace we will project into the world, and the more peaceful our planet will be. And I thought that was an idea worth spreading.
Thank you. Amen to that. And what's stopping us expressing what Jill Voltitola calls the deep inner peace circuitry? Well, on a superficial level, seems like a lot of things, whether it's gas bills that need to be paid, whether it's the threat of being sued, or of having terrorists blow us to bits. On a deeper level, money itself is a reinforcement of this fear and an expression of it. And so, of course, a lot of left hemisphere derived knowledge. We heard 2 weeks ago from Gabor Mate about his refusal to try and look at human health as if humans were isolated, separate machines. How much more coherent the picture became when we looked not only at the bio, but the social and the psychological as well. Now we're going to hear the interview with Elizabeth Soutouris, with which we opened the show, and this is also with Willis Harmon, and thank you to Scott London for this audio from his program Insight and Outlook from the 1990s.
I'm Scott London. Today a conversation with Elizabeth Soutouris and the late Willis Harmon about new frontiers in science.
I used to think that the mechanical worldview had imposed on us mechanical structures and that our societies were really built like machines. But the fact is that you can't turn living things into machinery. You can try to force them to behave like machinery, but they will not be machinery. And that's exactly why our economists can't predict anymore and our politics is falling apart, because we don't understand them as unhealthy living systems. We're trying to fix them like machines.
Science is exquisite for what it set out to do, which was to control the physical universe in various ways, which then could be turned to the benefit of the economy and so on. But if from that science we're going to try to construct a worldview that we're going to live by and we're going to guide our society by, then it's not adequate.
In the late 60s, historian of science Thomas Kuhn introduced the concept of a paradigm to describe a conceptual model or set of assumptions about reality. A paradigm, he said, allows scientists to interpret data, elaborate theories, and solve problems. It can be as all-encompassing as Newtonian physics, or as specific as the notion that life exists only on Earth. The trouble, he explained, is that paradigms are resistant to change. They're like closed systems in which all new data tends to confirm what's already known. Well, there's a growing recognition today that the old mechanistic paradigm passed down from the Enlightenment doesn't work very well in addressing the pressing questions of modern science. This is reflected in the emergence of new fringe disciplines with names like chaos, complexity, and living systems theory. Biologist Elizabeth Soutouris sees a shift today from what she calls mechanics to organics. Scientists no longer speak of the world as a giant clockwork machine, as the great Enlightenment thinkers conceived it, but rather as an organic living system. Soutouris makes this point in a new book written with the late social scientist Willis Harmon called Biology Revisioned. The book surveys recent changes in biology and looks at some of the social and cultural ramifications of these changes. Elizabeth Soutouris is an evolution biologist based in the Bay Area and author of several books, including Gaia and A Walk Through Time. She's also a futurist and former consultant to the United Nations. When I asked her about the shift toward a more organic perspective now taking place in the scientific community, she told me that many scientists still have trouble with the idea of nature as a living system.
Goes back to the Cartesian worldview, I think, in which Descartes proposed God as a grand engineer and his creations as mechanisms. That meant all nature was an array of mechanisms created by God the engineer, who then put a piece of his favorite, of his God mind into his favorite robot, man, so that he too could create machinery. Now, that was, whether you like it or not, a logically complete worldview. It accounted for everything. When the scientists decided they didn't need God in their worldview, they eliminated God from the Cartesian worldview but kept the idea of an array of mechanisms. Now, how do you explain the origin of mechanisms without a creator? By definition, a machine cannot exist without a creator. So if they're there and they couldn't have been assembled on purpose by an intentional creator, the only alternative was to say they came together by accident. And so you got these bizarre theories that literally say if enough parts of a Boeing 707 blow around a whirlwind in a junkyard, eventually one will assemble itself. This is going to appear to us, I think, the most bizarre and perhaps harebrained concept of how things work that's ever been proposed in the history of the world. And I think that it will be seen that way in the very near future, because it is fundamentally an illogical point of view. The problem was that they thought you had to choose between God, the purpose of inventor, and accident. We had no theory of self-creation as a perfectly natural, biological, universal event. Now we do, so we don't have to invoke either hypothesis.
In a nutshell, what is the Gaia theory?
Jim Lovelock is an atmospheric scientist from England, and he proposed that the Earth was a living, self-organizing entity and called it Gaia after the Greek name of the original goddess of creation who became the Earth itself. I differ a little bit with Lovelock and Margulis in the way I talk about Gaia, because I never call it either a hypothesis, which was what they first called it, or a theory. To me, it's a conceptualization of the Earth as alive to replace our conceptualization of the Earth as an array of mechanisms. And it's part of the transition in general from a mechanical worldview to an organic worldview, to see the Earth as alive. And for me, it's alive by definition. I use the definition of life which was proposed by two biologists from South America, Maturana and Varela, which goes by the name of autopoiesis. And autopoiesis is a Greek word, of course, meaning literally self-creation. And the definition goes, a living entity is any entity that constantly creates itself. And this really distinguishes it from a mechanism, because a machine is not constantly creating itself. In fact, if it changes itself at all, it's probably broken, and you'd rather it didn't do that, while a living thing is always changing or it's dead. And so it's a conceptualization, not a hypothesis or a theory. Within that conceptualization, that scientific framework, you would propose hypotheses and make theories about how it functions.
When James Lovelock first proposed this idea, he said he was using very poetic and metaphorical language. So in addition to presenting this as a scientific hypothesis, he was also using it as a metaphor. Well, today the Gaia theory, or the Gaia hypothesis, is bandied around a lot as a nice metaphor. But is it taken seriously by the scientific community?
Well, one of the things that happened was that people who get identified as New Age, and that means a lot of things, got very excited about the Gaia hypothesis from Jim Lovelock, because intuitively everyone knows that nature is alive, that the Earth is alive. In fact, our Western industrial culture is the only one in history that has not known the Earth to be alive. But when people say it's just a metaphor, we really have to look at that, because all science is metaphor. And when you say that nature is an array of mechanisms, that's absolutely as metaphorical as saying it's a living entity. There is no way to talk about anything new without invoking metaphors. So all of science is based on metaphor. If you talk about an atom as being like a little solar system with planets around it, or like whirlpools of energy in the more recent descriptions, these are all metaphors. Metaphor simply means that you take something familiar to you and use it as a pictograph or an image of what you're trying to describe that you don't yet understand well.
One of the enduring metaphors of our scientific worldview is Darwinism, of course, the whole idea of natural selection and survival of the fittest and so on. Darwinism has had a monumental impact on the way we think about evolution and our place in nature. And yet, in your book here, You're basically suggesting that we need to reassess Darwinian theory.
Yes, I think Darwin's theory was good for its time, but remember that its time was within a mechanical worldview framework. And to me, Darwin's theory is a very mechanical one in which you have accidents that occur. Remember, we talked earlier about explaining a natural world of machinery by accidental development. So that notion was around. And then the accidental variation in the genetic material is shaped by the environment, which Darwin saw as a kind of template. And if the cogs of these accidents fit into the wheels of the environment, then it would survive and the machine would run on. And if it didn't, it would die out. It would be inappropriate. It occurred to me that life seemed to be much too intelligent to proceed in its evolution by accident, and I kind of stuck my neck out 10 years ago by saying that. I thought probably genetic errors were repaired. Arthur Koestler had some similar ideas. I believe that was one of my sources for these ideas. Now the geneticists are becoming aware of this at a microscopic level. We can look at what's happening with the relationship between proteins and genes and cell membranes and all that. And it looks very much as though life does not proceed by accident but by design. And that, as I said in my book, the nucleus is really a giant library of genes accumulated throughout evolution, which can be drawn on under stress. Now, creatures such as sharks or cockroaches are very well adapted and don't apparently need to change. I call them bicycles in a jet age because they still function very well, although other species have gone on with totally different paths of evolution. But in other words, life changes itself only when it needs to. It knows how to conserve what works well and change what doesn't work well. And that's why you get very uneven evolution, not as in Darwinian theory, which would predict a very even rate of accident and an even rate of evolution for all species. And we certainly know that that's not true, and no geneticist today would uphold the ideas of Darwin completely. From my point of view, the concept of living systems should be the overarching concept for all of our educational institutions. In other words, we should be teaching the politics of living systems, the economics of living systems, the science of living systems. All of these things would be united by that central concept. And this is what would help us as humans to form healthy living systems. I used to think that the mechanical worldview had imposed on us mechanical structures and that our societies were really built like machines. But the fact is that you can't turn living things into machinery. You can try to force them to behave like machinery, but they will not be machinery. And that's exactly why our economists can't predict anymore and our politics is falling apart. Because we don't understand them as unhealthy living systems. We're trying to fix them like machines. It's very different curing a person and fixing a machine.
Biologist Elizabeth Satouris. Her new book, co-authored with Willis Harmon, is called Biology Revision. This is Insight and Outlook. I'm Scott London. Much of Biology Revisioned is written in the form of a dialogue between Elizabeth Satouris and Willis Harmon. The two authors were friends and had a long-standing interest in the frontiers of modern science. Harmon served as president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences for almost two decades. He was also a senior social scientist at SRI International for many years and taught at Stanford during the 40s and 50s. He authored quite a few books, one of the best known, Global Mind Change, has just been issued in a splendid revised edition. He passed away last year after a brief illness, shortly after he and Satouris completed Biology Revisioned. In what was to be one of his final interviews, I asked him about his perspective on what's happening in science today.
I think there are really two things happening. There are things that are happening out on the leading edge of science as we know it. And then there's a little bit of conversation about a more or less forbidden topic, which is a re-examination of the metaphysical assumptions that are implicit in Western science, but that they don't tell us about when we take science classes.
The metaphysical assumptions?
Yes. There's an epistemological assumption, that is, an assumption about how do you know what you claim to know. And then there's also an ontological assumption about what is the nature of reality. And so there's some of both. The epistemological assumption, for example, is that the way you find out about scientific knowledge is very largely in terms of being objective, that is, being distant from what's being observed, not being involved with it. There's an assumption that we really understand something when we reduce the complex to the simple, we reduce the whole to the parts. We call that reductionism, so that's an assumption. There's an ontological assumption, an assumption about the nature of reality, that the nature of reality is what is physically measurable. And if there's anything else, we won't say much about it in science, and if we don't say much about it, nobody else better say much about it, because science is the only widely recognized cognitive authority in the whole modern world.
Mm-hmm.
Western science has been tremendously good at what it does. And what it does is to lay the foundations for the manipulation of the physical world, the generation of new technologies, and so on. And nobody would attempt to downgrade that at all. But it nevertheless is limited. There are areas of human experience that it doesn't tell us much about. And if we took a more comprehensive epistemology, changed the rules of the game, so to speak, how do we know what we claim to know, then it could explore a wider range of human experience and be even more valuable.
Elizabeth Sartoris, who you're working with on the new book now, she says when Galileo looked through his telescope, that it was really an accident, you might say, or it had tremendous implications for the development of science, that he looked through it toward the stars instead of looking through it from the other end and using it as a microscope, and that maybe our focus on physics as the primary science would have instead resulted in the emphasis on biology as a primary science.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and that's just another way of saying what I was saying earlier about the, if we did come upon, by a more or less a historical accident, the idea that physics is the core discipline in the sciences, and what is real is the fundamental particles studied in physics. But you can imagine another argument which would have said, but living systems are the thing to be studied, and so biology should be the core discipline, and physics is a special case where there isn't evident life, but to really understand things you need to understand living systems. Now if you took that approach, then you would never would occur to you to say the real way to study organisms is to pull them apart until you get down to the molecular level and then study the molecules and understand the DNA so that you can understand the organism. You know, it would have from the very beginning been a study of everything as both a whole in itself and part of a larger whole. And it isn't that we wouldn't have the kind of scientific knowledge that we have, but we would have it in a very, very different context, and we would draw different inferences from it about the nature and the meaning of life and so on.
You've reassessed some of Darwin's ideas and also some of the neo-Darwinians who are getting a lot of attention mm-hmm. these days. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's right. There are many people who are questioning well, this term neo-Darwinism, perhaps we need to explain. Darwinism had the basic concepts of accidental mutations and survival of the fittest, but then added to that came the detailed knowledge about just how the basic knowledge about the organism is transmitted to the next generation through the genes and through the DNA and so on. And so that combination is called Neo-Darwinism, and it does seem to explain a lot, but it also has a lot of mysteries associated with it. And so there have been a number of criticisms essentially saying that it probably is going to require some change, but I'm not aware of very many people who've gone as far as Elizabeth and I want to in saying, but if we start from holes within holes, then the Neo-Darwinism is a framework, but it just isn't big enough to contain all of this. And if you think about all of this in terms of consciousness being present throughout, then you get a different look at it. A lot of what's known about evolution will still stand, but some of the mysteries will be viewed in a different way. Science is exquisite for what it set out to do, which was to control the physical universe in various ways, which then could be turned to the benefit of the economy and so on. It's just that we've reached a point where, since it now is the only cognitive authority that we teach everybody about, we assume this is the one thing that everybody around the world knows for true. Well, if we're going to take that attitude toward it, then we need to insist that it broaden its aperture, that it look at the full range of human experience, not just at a constrained range. And to do that, you have to reassess the metaphysical assumptions underlying it and understand how some of those assumptions that were made early in the game have, in fact, been limiting with regard to the overall. Let's put it this way. If the place in society for science were merely to create technologies, it's okay the way it is. But if from that science we're going to try to construct a worldview that we're going to live by and we're going to guide our society by, then it's not adequate. And these questions must be raised.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me something about your own approach to science. At a certain point, you must have begun to challenge your own traditional viewpoint and started to explore alternative approaches to science. Tell me about your own journey in that respect.
Well, I taught engineering at Stanford University for a good many years, and that evolved over teaching about systems, and then it became not just engineering systems, but engineering, economic, social systems. And about at that point, it didn't really fit into any department at Stanford anymore, and I moved over to Stanford Research Institute, or now it's SRI International, to do research on whole social systems, and particularly with regard to the kinds of changes that are taking place in modern society, the kinds of challenges to modern society, the environmental problems and so on. And we were trying to look to the future 20 or 30 years or so, but the more that we looked at that together, the more we said, this is just after the 60s, and there seems to be a great deal of change in consciousness that's been associated with the 60s, and the more we looked into that, the more we began to say to ourselves and to our clients that it looks as though in the popular culture there's a spreading group that is really operating from a different worldview. And it's one they've discovered themselves, and it isn't exactly traditional religion, and it certainly isn't traditional science. It's something else. It looks as though there's a new cosmology coming into the culture.
Well, it seems to me, I think I've read a bit about SRI, that they were involved in pretty controversial research during the 60s and 70s, and like remote viewing and so on, and doing work for the CIA. Is that true?
Well, there was another group there that was working on remote viewing and various kinds of anomalous sorts of phenomena that don't fit into the conventional scientific worldview. And yes, some of that research was funded by the CIA, because, you know, if you've got a certain mindset, it's very, very interesting to know if you can send a mind over to the Soviet Union at that time and see where the submarines are under the fog bank and things like that. That was a separate group. We kept in touch with what they were doing, and we assumed that that was one of the many inputs that were contributing to our broader picture, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting because, you know, a lot of the research that's being done in the emerging sciences of complexity and chaos now is coming out of the Santa Fe Institute. But as you may know, a lot of the research there has been funded by big business and by arch conservatives and Wall Street investors who are looking to take that research and apply it to very narrow political and economic interests. And I think this is a very scary idea, that the latest breakthroughs in science are being applied to increase the power of those who already have quite a lot.
I think it's really an important issue that you raise. We did have a tradition at one time of trying to see that at least a major portion of the research that goes on is not biased by its funding sources. And universities felt this was very important to them. I think that caution has become somewhat weaker. And partly it's because research has become rather expensive in many areas, and you've got to get your funding from somewhere. If it's a government agency or big business that fund it, you can suspect that there may be some biased interest there. And certainly there are some topics that are easy to fund, and there are other topics that are very difficult to fund because you're asking questions that might even be threatening to the potential funder. So that certainly is a part of the...
But this seems to be a central issue for people who are really on the cutting edge of research, though, because I can't imagine that many... truly independent-minded scientists and thinkers who are exploring these areas can be very popular with the establishment. And yet the establishment is responsible for the funding. So,
but the establishment is also shifting. So there are things that happen under the table sometimes. So there's at least a modest amount of funding that sometimes comes from sources that are not terribly visible. I think what you're saying is just one aspect of something that I would put this way, that the single most important political issue for the next decade or two is what worldview is going to guide all the institutions of society, what's going to be the dominant worldview, and who's going to control it, and who's going to control the research that leads to it or supports it. That's why we've circled back in this conversation to where we started from, which is that the critical issue in science is not what can you now learn from quantum physics or chaos theory or whatever. Much more fundamental than that is the question, are there ontological and epistemological assumptions about the nature of reality and how you find out about reality, that have been a part of Western science all along. That's why it's different from what science was in any other culture. That may be part of why it was so successful in the limited arena of generating new technologies, new ways of manipulating the physical environment. But at the same time, that's exactly why it's not just a scientific or a philosophical, but a political question in the deepest sense. What bias is there in our present concept of science, and do we need to re-examine that at this point?
That's Willis Harmon, the late president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and author of a new book with Elizabeth Satouris called Biology Revisioned. Harmon is also the author of Global Mind Change, a popular book about our changing worldview in the West. It's just been published in a revised second edition. I spoke with Harmon in San Francisco shortly before he passed away last year.
Sweat the elements that you are. Count it up all the years. I'm on my own. You're selling our old ways. Stop telling me the right way to go. I'm on my own.
My name is Richard Walensky. How do we view the self? Do people from different cultures view the self in different ways? And if they do, how does it affect their art, their politics, their relationships, even how they examine the world through their eyes? Novelist Gish Jen, when asked to write an intellectual autobiography for a three-lecture series at Harvard University, published in one book as Tiger Writing, looked over her own work and the work of others and came up with the notion that there are two basic types of self: the independent self, which sees the world through the lens of its own centrality, and the interdependent self, which views the world in a communitarian way. How do these two selves, one from Europe and America, the other from the rest of the world, work separately and together to create the world that we live in? How does this affect literature, what we write, and what we read? Gish Jen recently joined me in our KPFA Berkeley studios. I asked her what she meant by the terms independent self and interdependent self.
Psychologists today like to use the term independent self, but probably in a more layman's way of thinking about it, probably what people think of as a more individualistic self. And the interdependent self is a more collectivist self. Also, I think when we think about the difference between a more individualistic versus a more collectivist outlook, we're typically thinking about it being kind of an East versus West thing, or I should say West versus East thing, with West being more individualistic and the East being more collectivist. But in fact, the difference is really between the West and the rest, you know? When we think about a highly individualistic self, we're really talking about just Western Europe and America, and the collective self is really the self that dominates in the rest of the world. So we mean Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and also parts of Europe. So, you know, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, as I talk about in my book, that includes novelists like Orhan Pamuk, Milan Kundera, as well as many other figures, of course. And I will say also when we think about America, of course, there are many, many, many pockets of people's communities which are very, very collectivist in feeling. A psychologist once told me about the wonderful basketball game she had gone to where there's a Native American team playing a European American team, and the Native American team, all the teammates all shared one water bottle, which the European American team, everybody had their own bottle.
You say in the book that the independent self would see the individual as unique, whereas the interdependent looks at it a somewhat different way?
Yeah, I think that in a very general kind of way, an individualistic outlook is one that sees the self as a kind of self-contained entity. So its focus, therefore, is on the truth within, and that self tends to place a lot of emphasis on the uniqueness of the individual. So it's very important to be like a snowflake. You know, we want to know in what way am I a particular snowflake. It's a very important question to the individualistic person. To somebody with a more collectivist outlook, or a more interdependent outlook, That is a person who sees him or herself primarily, I mean, not exclusively, of course, but primarily in relationship to other people. And the question for that self, very generally, is how do I fit in this larger whole? What is my role? What are my duties? What are my obligations? What does the larger whole mean? And it is the larger entity where meaning lies, right? So therefore, they're not so focused on the inside, is they're more focused on things which are outside.
You give an example of this in Tiger Riding about your father's memoir. Can you go into a little bit of why that would be related to the interdependent self as opposed to, I don't know, your standard
right.
American memoir of, I did this, I did that, I am this, I am that.
Right. Well, you know, as a novelist, I'm interested in what it means for narrative. And therefore, when I was looking at my father's autobiography, this is something that he wrote when he was 86. He wrote it for our family, just to really to say a few things that we might want to know about his life. He wrote us a series of emails to me. And very interestingly, you know, he did not mention himself until page 8, you know, and when he finally mentions his own birth, it is in parentheses in conjunction with another event. And I think that this manner of narration obviously provides quite a strong contrast to the Western or the independent narrative, where when we think autobiography, we think auto, you know, begins with me, like David Copperfield. It starts with I am born, right? That's the most important fact. And what was happening, you know, when I was born, you know, the clocks were chiming, you know, I was born with a call, whatever. In my father's case, he does not ever tell us anything about, you know, what he was like as a child. Was he a rambunctious child? Was he a quiet child? He never tells us. It's simply not his focus. His focus is much, much broader than that.
Well, he was also a professor when he came to America. You relate this view of the world to his work as a professor, but also to the educational success of Asian students in the United States.
I hate to generalize, and I will say that while my book is very much about these cultural templates, which I feel to be very much a part of our present reality, I do think they influence all of us. That said, it is also true that, you know, we all pick and choose, modify, you know, these things are not deterministic. And so therefore, you know, I would never say that, you know, there is this Eastern template and it leads to the success of Asian students. For one thing, I am talking about a template, which is also the template for many other parts of the world, which are not known for academic success. I don't want to generalize to that degree. But it is true that I do think that this is one ingredient in the phenomenon that we sometimes see. And again, many, many caveats. I mean, I think many people know that Asians in America and Asian Americans are actually much higher performing than Asians in Asia. Do you know what I mean? So that, you know, the immigrants are a higher performing group. So, you know, there are many factors at play. That said, it is true that if you come from an orientation where your role is important and also where effort, what you do is very important, more important than your innate talent. You are a person who works. So I think that many people from a more independent, you know, outlook tend to ask questions, well, how smart am I? I think that from an interdependent point of view, you know, you're not actually thinking about, you know, you don't ask yourself, well, you know, what are my given talents? You ask yourself, what should I be doing? and lo and behold, you know, that does tend to produce startling results, I guess, at least from an American point of view.
Yes, Jen, we will be getting on a little bit to the nature of fiction and how it relates
yes.
to this, but one more question in terms of the thesis in the book is you talk quite a bit about how certain cultures, I think you, in this case it's Singaporean, if I have that right, look at background